from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. The number of Americans 65 and older who still work is up by 60% from a decade ago. That's according to a recent article in Harper's Magazine entitled The End of Retirement. Some say retirement, as America understands it today, is on its way out. Not every older American is facing down poverty. Some people enjoy working well into their golden years. But if you're popping ibuprofen to ward off the pain from standing on your feet all day and worrying about how long your housing situation is going to hold up, there's nothing golden about retirement. That's coming up on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. If you choose to work into retirement or switch to an encore career doing something you love, working on your own terms, work can be an immensely satisfying thing. But if you have to work, whether you want to or not, whether it puts you in physical pain or not, well, that's another thing entirely. Jessica Bruder is a journalist with a passion for following contemporary subcultures, and in her cover article for Harper's Magazine this month, she tells us about a group of older Americans traveling the highways in battered old RVs, hunting for temporary gigs and cheap medical care. And she's inspired us to go into an entire segment looking at this question of working past retirement when you don't really want to. She joins us now by phone. Jessica Bruder, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We also have here in studio Roxanne Murray, bear with me now, Program Director for the Senior Community Service Employment Program and Economic Security Initiative Center at the Family Service Agency of San Francisco. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And then also on the phone, Richard Johnson, Senior Fellow and Director of the Program on Retirement Policy at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, Jessica Bruder, why don't we start with you? I guess my first question would be, you know, snowbirds have been looking for decent RV parking for, what, two decades now? What's different about the people you profile?
What's different are essentially the economic challenges. While there are still plenty of snowbirds going from place to place in RVs, there's a much different, the spectrum is different. Recreational vehicles aren't only for recreation. You also do have a fair amount of people who've taken to the road and are seeking work in different places. And while some of them do want to stay fit and stay active, for others, it's really the only way to keep in gas money and food because there's not enough to retire on.
Roxanne Murray, you work with people in the age group, I guess, 55 to 87 in San Francisco attempting to transition back to the workforce. Are you meeting people who are living in RVs because they have to live in the RV as opposed to vacation in it?
Well, we have lots of people that are in need of the type of training that gets offered through CSAP, some of whom are homeless, some of whom are living in, familial situations, SROs, which are single room occupancy environments. And we've had people who have resided in RVs as well as people who have hidden out in boats.
Hidden out in boats.
Yes, on the docks. So basically, not allowed to stay there, but they've, been able to, or they've secured those purposes because they had nowhere else to go.
Is this the kind of thing you've heard about, Richard Johnson?
Certainly, I've heard about the economic troubles that some older Americans face. We tend to think that older Americans are generally pretty wealthy, pretty well off. And on average, that's probably true. On average, their poverty rates are much lower than the general population. But there's still about 9% of the population of the 65-plus population in poverty today. And when you adjust that poverty rate for things like medical spending, you find that the true poverty rate rises to more like 15%. So economic need among the elderly is a real problem in this country.
I imagine, too, that when you're talking about high-cost places to live like California or New York, where the real estate is a serious consideration, that maybe it's more than just, 9 out of 100.
That's right. It certainly varies around the country. Some high-cost places would experience higher rates of economic need. And certainly, you know, one of the things that we think that older people, what they really spend their money on is healthcare, and yet the biggest item in their budget is housing. And so high housing cost areas are going to experience more folks in economic need.
Well, we could continue talking about numbers and statistics, but Jessica Bruder, I'd love it if you could share with us the story of one of the people that you profiled in this article. I urge people to run out and get the August issue of Harper's Magazine. It's an amazing read. Just tell us about one person.
Sure. Well, let me tell you about Linda May. Linda May, 64, almost 65. She was the lead character in the story. And one of the last things I want to do is portray Linda as a victim. Linda is a tough cookie. She is amazing. She is resilient. Spent many hours chatting with her in her RV and genuinely enjoyed her company. A really cool lady. But like a lot of people in this country, she worked all her life but didn't really amass any sort of lasting security. The era of the pension is long over. Linda has worked in construction, both behind the desk and actually building things. She's been a cocktail waitress. She's been an insurance executive. She has worked her butt off for all of her life and done what you're supposed to do, but she didn't really accrue any lasting security. So back in, maybe 4 years ago already, she was working as a cashier in a Home Depot in New River and putting that money back into the rent on a tiny trailer. The trailer was in New River. The Home Depot was nearby. But basically, she realized, she found out her Social Security was only going to be $499 a month, which is quite low, low even by what our averages are, and that she was going to be sitting behind that counter at the Home Depot forever. So it's not that she could have chosen to do that and to do that kind of never stop working, but instead, Linda's a bit of a rebel soul. She decided, forget about this, and you know why keep pouring the rent money into this other trailer? She waited on Craigslist. She saved and saved, and she bought this RV that was a little beat up. It had been driven into a telephone pole, but again, Linda is ambitious and
she's
tough
handy and with tools. Yeah,
great with tools, and she said, "I'm going to make a new life for myself," and that's exactly what she did. She got out on the road.
You know, I have to say, reading the story, that it seems like she made the right choice. You know, if you're going to be working part-time, contract jobs, temporary jobs, marginal jobs, you could do it anywhere. So why not have fun traveling the country and giving yourself a setup where you can move? You're flexible. You can go where the work is and go where the fun is.
Sure. And again, it's not all fun working the overnight shift at Amazon on the concrete floor and getting repetitive stress injuries from using the scanner and, you know, having to go to the ER one night in Linda's case. You know, it's surely not all summer camp. And I worry because I think some of the recruiters who are seeking older migrant workers, in an almost patronizing way, they say, come feel like a kid again. Come have fun. Come see our
It's kind of like labor. The jobs that we have when we're 17 or 23 and we're just getting started. But surely Linda May and other people like her, they know what the score is. They know an Amazon warehouse is not, you know, a walk in the park.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Roxanne Murray, can you tell us about some of the kinds of jobs you see your clients taking on?
Well, in terms of the types of employment they secure once they've been through the CSEP program, it really varies. I mean, we have people in the program who initially came in with no skills, little skills, and then when those individuals are seeking employment, they tend to get the lower skilled type of jobs when they can get them, and that's not a difficult kind of thing.
Really.
Exactly. But we also have individuals that are seeking our services who, since the recession, who had been long-term employed and who probably by any stretch of the imagination would have never needed a program like CSEP, but who find themselves now at the doorstep because it's the type of service that they need. So those individuals, we've had attorneys, we've had engineers, we've had very skilled long-term employed people who have significant education. They come through the program, and they do the best that they can, and they have to either retool or retrain because for most of them, they're unable to transition back into the world that they used to know.
Now, these are attorneys and engineers. why can't somebody in that situation call up their old buddies at the old office and say, anybody going on maternity leave? I could work for 3 months. I could consult maybe part-time.
Well, some of the feedback that we've gotten from people has to do with the fact that when they leave or when they're put in those positions and then they're displaced and they don't have the capacity to live the same formal lifestyles, they end up losing oftentimes those connections with other
folks. So they're not playing golf on the course with their old colleagues.
No, they're not doing that, no.
Oh, man. Is this what you've heard about Richard Johnson? Does this make sense? The Great Recession is still with us in many ways? There's a hangover?
Oh, very much so, and particularly for older workers. So the unemployment rate has declined overall, ticked up a little bit this morning, but it's lower than it was, or much lower than it was during the peak of the recession, but still higher and still higher for older people than it has been in the past. And one of the things that's particularly difficult for older people is that it just takes them so long, if they become unemployed, to find work. Older people tend to have lower unemployment rates than younger people, but if they lose their job, it's really hard to find another one. Employers tend to be reluctant still to hire people who are older because they think perhaps that their skills are out of date. They think it's going to be hard to teach them the new skills that they're going to need. And they're worried that, well, they're not going to be around that long. They're 55, they're 60. How much longer are they really going to be in the workforce? Why waste my money, the employers think, training and hiring someone who's not going to be with me for a very long time. So that's really a challenge that older workers still face today, even though the economy is recovering.
So there aren't employers who think, you know, boy, this person is desperate. I can get this guy to work for a cut rate to accept a contract job. You know, I'm not going to offer a pension in Benny's or anything like that because I know he's 67 and he needs some money coming in.
Yeah, you know, it's really just the opposite, that employers look at an older person and they think about that salary history that person's had and they say, well, you know, they're just not going to be happy working at the rate that I'm willing to pay him. I'm going to go for a younger person who's not used to that big salary and maybe that person will be more satisfied.
We're calling out now to listeners, forum listeners. You are the experts. If you are in the job market past what you thought was going to be your retirement, we want to hear about it. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786. And now that you've got your pen at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Jessica Bruder, it's not all sob stories, but you write about this fact that the landscape has shifted, that basically the things that we look to rest on in the past are gone. Even when we say pensions is something, you know, I don't know, maybe our grandparents' generation enjoyed, but 401ks aren't quite the same thing.
Yeah, pensions and buggy whips are kind of gone into the same box. One quick thing I wanted to add with Rich's comment, though, was he's right. So many of these older people are reticent to hire them, and they're educated, and it's not – I wanted to mention that the people I saw doing this work on the road, you see all kinds of people. I met a guy who was a former State Department fellow. I met people with advanced degrees. I met a gentleman who used to be the head of product development for McDonald's. So any effort to pigeonhole them and to say, you know, that these people were either slackers or, I mean, it's just untrue. So I just wanted to toss that in there. But, yeah, in terms of pensions, I really do believe that the American worker has been sold a bill of goods. The idea of 401ks when they were first marketed in the 80s was that here's some great instrument of financial liberation. You can choose where your money goes. When in truth, the heavy lifting was coming off the shoulders of employers and going onto the shoulders of employees. So instead of knowing that you've got a defined benefit plan that's going to be there for you, you now know that you've got a defined contribution, but, you know, that A, you're putting the most into, and B, it's more, you know, it's going to be vulnerable to the tides of the economy, and that's on your shoulders making those financial choices.
So wherever the market is when you retire, that's the situation you have to deal with. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. I'm wondering if you can talk about the kinds of jobs that people are finding, these temporary seasonal jobs, like the ones at Amazon warehouses.
Sure. I mean, there's a huge range. And again, there are some people in RVs who are out there eager to stay fit and doing some of the lighter duty jobs to stay active. So I don't want to say that, you know, it's everybody, but then there are people who are taking the Amazon jobs, which frankly, that's one heck of a job to take on if you don't need the money, and it is mostly older people. There are people who go join the beet harvest in the Red River Valley, and oh gosh, that is cold, cold, cold. You're there for 12 hours straight, day shift, night shift, and you know, a lot of these people, if you're taking samples off the beet trucks, that means hauling around 30-pound bags of produce. There are people who check for leaks in gas lines. There are people who sell fireworks by the side of the road. There are people who man Christmas tree lots. If you ever go to a Christmas tree lot and you see the RV parked back there, that could well be a work camper. There are tons and tons of lighter duty jobs, often maintaining campgrounds. So that would be taking campers' fees, cleaning toilets, making sure everything's in working order. But the amazing thing to me is that there are just hundreds of employers clamoring for workers, and most of them are in this older demographic.
Does that sound like what you're saying, Roxanne Murray?
Well, in San Francisco, we are currently experiencing, you know, high job possibilities for people here. But unfortunately for the population that I serve, the 55-plus, they're challenging. They're IT, they're construction. And then they are also in, you know, in the hospitality area. The majority of folks in that we serve, the types of employment they usually secure happen to be in like customer service arenas, administrative support types of positions. Sometimes there's the occasional food service. We also have individuals who, interestingly enough, are very familiar with the tech environment and have secured employment in those arenas as well.
We have somebody on the line now, Janet in San Francisco. Your mom is still working.
Hi, my name is Janet, and I appreciate the. I guess it's a little too close to my heart. My mom is in her 80s; she's still working. Most of our family friends, we've grown up in San Francisco, are old people, and they are still working. And let's address the elephant in the room here. It's not about not being able to train people who can't manage to get new skills. It's about age discrimination. Nobody wants to have old around, and let's just like call it like it is.
Janet, what is your mother doing right now?
My mom was a advertising executive, and she's now a fundraiser for an arts organization. But I just wish that we could get a little more real here and really talk about the age discrimination. It's the kind of discrimination that was levied against Asian people and African Americans, and we're all, you know, very, very upset that that happened and doing everything we can to make that better for those segments of the population. And yet age discrimination is sort of like a joke, or people laugh about it, or, oh, those old people just want to get out in their RV and do new fun things. The rents in San Francisco and the cost of living are so untenable. My siblings and I do we all work. We all do the best we can, but we just cannot make enough money.
Is it the sort of thing where you're thinking you've got to head to a cheaper neighborhood further out on the outskirts?
A cheaper neighborhood. They are no cheaper neighborhoods.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, like not within San Francisco, but, you know, perhaps farther beyond. We've lost Janet. Roxanne Murray, you know, this is a big point, though. I mean, you know, San Francisco and for that matter, any of those neighborhoods desirable to people who do have upper middle class jobs, you know, they're rising to the point where a lot of people within those neighborhoods, if they can cash out by selling a home, are doing so, going maybe across the bay to the East Bay, you know, going farther out to Stockton or Sacramento. Do you see that kind of thing happening? Or maybe people just even chasing cheaper rents in places like Stockton and Sacramento?
Well, I want to thank the caller, you know, for making that point, because she's correct on many levels. There is a lot of ageism that is happening in the work arena, and it's very, very difficult, like it is, to establish or prove other types of discrimination to bring a cause of action specifically around that. And the challenge that we have, you know, with the people that we serve is that they tend to be low income now. We have formerly middle income people who now happen to be low income. And by the time you get to that point, a lot of the options that other people might be able to exercise are off the table. If you don't own a home, you know, you can't sell a home. If you're in terms of your health, if your health is part of a consideration and you have less economic stability, it creates less opportunity for you to engage in options that would benefit you. So for the people that we serve, the bottom line is they have to, you know, go through the process. They have to work really hard, usually for a lot less money, simply to be able, you know, sometimes to put food on the table and have a roof over their heads.
Let's turn now to Sylvia. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yes, I am here. Thank you for having me. I wanted to comment that both my husband and myself are over 65, and we are on Medicare, but what we found was that our disposable cash wasn't cutting it for either of us. And so we both, he's doing some consulting, and I'm working for DM in a local hospital, and it's amazing how welcome we have been. I mean, I don't make what I used to make in the job market, but I think we're so welcome because the work ethic that we bring to the table and our willingness to do just about anything. So, you know, I mean, it's out there. It's just, you know, oftentimes you do have to have help. You do have to have friends. You do have to network. But, you know, it's out there, and we are appreciated. You know, I mean, older people are appreciated.
Sylvia, no. Do you find that that's the story for your friends, or is it a mixed bag?
Well, I think, interestingly, I was at my book club last night, and one of my friends, who is older than me, is just started a job, and she is very happy to work, and she doesn't need to. It's just, I think it's just a mixed bag.
It's a mixed bag. Richard Johnson, do you see this mixed bag playing out? I mean, there are clearly some people who want to work or who enjoy working, but I think it's fair to say we are talking about people who don't have a choice in the matter, who are looking for work. This question of ageism, how real is it? Are there numbers that are backing up what people are experiencing in their personal lives?
Yeah, so, I mean, Nicole is absolutely right. It really is a diverse group of older workers out there. Some are highly valued, others are not. Age discrimination is hard to prove. It's hard to show empirically in the data how widespread it is. But there have been several studies that have, I think, clearly shown that it does exist. So, for example, studies where identical resumes have been sent out to employers, the younger applicant is more likely to get a call back than the older applicant. There have been studies that have looked at employment rates across states that have stronger age discrimination penalties than other states. And it's where those penalties are more severe that you see more employment for older folks, suggesting that when those strong penalties aren't there, employers are more likely to engage in age discrimination. So I think it clearly exists. On the other hand, there are a lot of...
Really quickly now, Richard.
A lot of employers do value, as Sylvia said, the maturity that older workers bring.
We're talking about working past what you thought would be retirement. What's your story? Call us at 866-733-6786. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. This hour, we're talking about the fragile financial picture facing many baby boomers. We have with us on the line Claire Lomax, a local who's got an interesting story to tell. Claire, thank you for joining us today. We seem not to have her. Let's move on then. Let's talk next to Nick in San Francisco. Tell us your story. Hi, Nick.
Yeah, so I had a comment. So my background and nationality is Indian, And we have a history of sort of living in joint families. And so even though, you know, I'm kind of like a second-generation American, we still, you know, live in joint families. And so my parents live with me, my wife, and my kids. And even though my dad hasn't been able to find work for a while, you know, it works out pretty well. We just have this culture of kind of taking care of our families. And so I wanted to sort of put that out there and find out, you know, a little bit more about the sort of demographic.
That's a good question. Roxanne Murray, it does seem like a lot of immigrant families who have, you know, within one generation, or perhaps they've just come over, come with that value. I'm going to take care of mom and dad and aunt and uncle. We're going to have a house that has, you know, an extra bedroom, or we'll make it work somehow. But you don't seem to see that. Statistics don't suggest that, on the whole, Americans are taking in their older relatives.
Well, that's our experience. Yeah, there are some cultures, as the caller indicated, where even now today, that's an aspect of the culture that they still honor. And I think what we see oftentimes for situations for people who, you know, for Americans, let's just say people who are born here and who have lived here. The cultures are different. We recognize that we have to respect all cultures, but I also think that in terms of what it's been like for some of the families here, there's instability, you know, across generations. So there are young people that are feeling instability economically, and then there are, you know, the children of the parents may be experiencing instability economically. So I think, you know, lots of what we're talking about tracks the trends that are connected, you know, to, you know, class, race, you know, ethnicity, gender. All of those things are sort of combined and can create a situation or a scenario that makes it sometimes difficult for that intergenerational care to be ongoing or sustained over a long period of time.
Richard Johnson, it does seem as if we're talking about support structures or the lack thereof or the diffuseness of those support structures. If your parent is living in Chicago, much as you want to help as a middle-aged person, you might not be able to if it means closing up shop where you live in the Bay Area or vice versa.
Oh, that's absolutely right. You know, what we've seen over the past few decades, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s, the share of older adults living with their adult children has dropped off dramatically. As older incomes increase because of expanding Social Security benefits during that period, many people, older people, wanted to live alone. They enjoy their privacy, and so we didn't see that much co-residence going on across generations. We still do see it to some extent among low-income people, but much less likely today than it used to be. And in fact, older people are more likely to give money to their children than the other way around. We're still seeing a lot of older people who are helping out their children, even those in their 40s, in their 50s perhaps, and less money going up to the older generation. What the younger people tend to do is they do tend to provide hands-on care when their parents become frail, when they need that kind of help. But as you say, as families become more mobile, as people, children and parents move away from each other, that kind of assistance becomes harder and harder.
Jessica Bruder, you know, I imagine you've talked to a lot of people on the road, you know, where the last thing they would want to imagine is moving in with their children. Is there any appeal that you felt personally looking at people basically making their own choices and having the freedom to do so?
Absolutely. But by the same token, I did meet a bunch of people who had lived with their kids, in some cases for a period of years. And a lot of them, A, there's a sense of pride. I don't want to rely on my kids. And B, just a genuine fear of burdening them. So while I saw a lot of people who had left that situation, generally it wasn't because they'd been pushed out by uncaring children. It was because often on the children's side, the resources were not thick on the ground, and the parent was worried about straining the child and also wanted the autonomy. But, you know, it's not easy out on the road either. People who do create these impromptu families and communities that help a lot. But, you know, a lot of people, you're out there by yourself behind the wheel. You're maintaining a rig. It's not an easy way to go.
I imagine, too, you know, the decisions are different based on whether you're feeling like you're strong or whether you're feeling like you're frail, and that can change in a heartbeat.
Absolutely. I mean, bodies don't last forever, and neither do automobiles, which is the challenge with both maintaining ourselves and maintaining these rigs on the road. So that is the big unanswered question kind of at the end of my piece is, what happens? What happens when you can't do this anymore? And I got some answers and plans from individual people, but not enough to, you know, to assuage my concern and worry about some of them.
But what kind of plans did they suggest?
Oh, I got everything from bury me in the desert, I'll do this forever, even if it ends like Thelma and Louise, to I'm going to buy a school bus and dig a trench in the earth and bury it, and that's going to be my home, to Linda, who does construction, and with her daughter, they're trying to purchase a parcel of land where she can build this kind of marvel of 70s sustainable architecture called an earthship that involves hay bales and tires and bottles. And frankly, if anybody can do it, Linda May can, but it is a really ambitious project.
Well, maybe we should ask if she's got some extra bedrooms
we could use.
Roxanne Marie, I see you striving to speak here.
No, what I wanted to say about, you know, the population that we serve, you know, formerly a middle income people who are now low income people, or people that have been low income for a very long time. Despite that fact, these are people who are fiercely autonomous. They're proud. The whole notion of wanting to take care of themselves and be independent is incredibly part of their ethic, their life ethic and their work ethic. But I do want to say that a lot of what people can do is based on their ability to have options and choices. And if you are struggling to eat, or if you're struggling to pay rent, or if you're struggling, you know, to just get a job, or, you know, the types of things that are impacting individuals who are struggling financially, it's about they have a lack of those choices. So despite the fact that they are engaged, that they want to work, that they want to be a part of this whole process, bringing the economy back, finding self-sufficiency so that they can live independent lives and quality lives, I think we do really need to focus, at least for my population, and understand that they have limited options and limited choices, and they're basically trying to do the best that they can with the cards they've been dealt.
Let's turn now to the phones again. Ian in San Francisco.
Yeah, so with the coming of the Reagan Revolution and the move towards the 401k, American corporations have basically abandoned the pension, you know, that many Americans had. And that left many people with simply Social Security, which means then that Social Security is now the pension for many, many Americans.
Yeah.
And so what I want to say on that is we need to increase the amount that goes towards Social Security now that we've done away with the pension, which is fine, but that means we've got to move to something else, and that's Social Security. And so people need to get paid more. And how would we pay for it? Well, we're going to, of course, have to tax the wealthy. And why do I say that? Take a look at Mitt Romney's 2010 tax return, which you can see online. There's nothing on line 7, wages and salaries. That means he and Ann paid nothing into Social Security that year. We need to tax that income below line 7 to help pay for Social Security.
Well, Richard Johnson, Ian is suggesting something that quite a few people are suggesting. Can you talk about the numbers? What would it look like if we did tax wealthy individuals more?
It would certainly help Social Security's finances. You know, the trustees, Social Security trustees, just came out with their report a few days ago, earlier this week, and demonstrated once again that the system is going to run short of money in about 2033, so we're talking about, you know, about 20 years, and so something has to be done. And one possibility is that we extend the payroll tax on people who make more than we're right now above the tax limit. The tax limit now is about $115,000. So if we raise that to $200,000, that would go a long way toward closing the funding gap. But, you know, it's a complicated issue. And one of the reasons why it's complicated is Social Security is designed to replace your income, your earnings in retirement. So that's why it's a payroll tax. It's a tax on your earnings, not on other types of income. Many people think it's important that everyone gets a good deal from Social Security, so that if you start taxing the wealthy too much to pay for Social Security, is Social Security going to become a welfare-type program that a vast majority of the population is no longer interested in? Social Security has worked, and it has persisted since 1935 because the vast majority of Americans thinks it's a good deal, and people are getting a good deal from it. And if we start putting too much of a tax burden on high-income people, that could erode popular support for the program.
At least among higher-income people.
That's
but
right.
It hasn't the story
but the higher
changed?
But higher-income people vote a lot and have a lot of, you know,
they do.
Have a lot of power.
They,
so.
They have a lot of influence on the political system, but we are talking about an economic system that is looking less and less like what we saw through much of the 20th century, which was a big, robust middle class. We seem to be moving into a situation that looks a lot more like the 19th century.
We are seeing much more income inequality, much more wealth inequality now than we used to. And that is a real problem. And certainly the erosion of traditional pensions has exacerbated the problem, I think, for many older people and people who are going to be retiring in the coming years. Though I think, you know, there's no reason why a 401k plan cannot work well. The reason why it hasn't worked well primarily is because people have not been contributing that much to their plan. One of the advantages of a 401k plan is that as you move from job to job, you take your benefit with you. In the traditional defined benefit plan, that didn't happen. So if people are holding, you know, seven jobs over their lifetime, they're really not going to get much from that traditional plan, and they could get more from a 401k.
But that said, if on the day I retire, we're in another great recession and the value of my stock portfolio has shrunk to, you know, nibbles, it's not necessarily a result of how much I saved or, you know, the stock choices I made. The whole economy has gone foomp.
That's right. I mean, what you sort of highlight is this question of what do you do with this pot of money when you retire? And if you're going to take, you know, take that money and annuitize it immediately, and the stock market crashed the day before you retired, then you've suffered a big hit. But if the stock market crashed the day before you retire, you would not spend all that money immediately, and hopefully the stock market would return, those values would increase, and so they would last a longer period in retirement than it might seem at the moment you retire. I mean, we look at what happened in 2007. We had this tremendous stock market crash, but the stock market has returned to that level, to the level it was at before the crash by now. People lost some expected returns during that period, but, you know,
so if you're in a position to wait it out, you can, you know, it'll what goes down will go up as well. Thank you so much for that question, Ian. Wow, generated a lot of discussion. Rick emails, I think that those of us who must work have a responsibility to work. The reason I think is we could have made choices and saved and been more responsible. I'm 66 and plan on working until I'm able to work, unable to work rather, because of divorce and other bad choices. This is not someone else's fault. Another listener emails, I've just found a job after searching for over 5 years. I'm about to turn 61. I hold a master's, bachelor's, and now a state teaching credential, 4.0 GPA, worked for major companies in California, most of which are technology-based. My tech skills are, in contrast to the common stories in the news, current, and in fact probably greater than the tech skills of even many young adults. I know I now teach those kids. A reminder, Roxanne Murray, that for all the stereotypes of tech-focused workers being, you know, out of touch, well, you know, what programming languages do you know? Maybe the employer needs to check in and see whether that stereotype is matched by the actual truth on the resume. You know, maybe that older worker is as current as somebody else who's coming in wearing skinny jeans and Adidas sneakers.
I agree. Absolutely. And one of the challenges that the older workers face, as well as, you know, the health issues, potential health issues, maybe the lack of access, you know, to, you know, wealth issues, are the stereotypes. You know, that they, you know, that they're difficult to work with. They, you know, they have attitudes. They're resistant or reluctant, you know, to change. You know, they don't know anything, you know, about IT. And, you know, the bad thing about that is stereotypes, regardless of age or anything else, are just exactly that, stereotypes. And so we do, we try to the extent that we can through the trainings to make sure that our individuals are getting the types of, you know, beginner or intermediate or advanced, where they can get it, access to technology. Because, frankly, if you don't know anything about that, it makes it incredible, not just to get a job, but to sort of function.
Bilona in Redwood City.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to shift the focus a little bit. I'm 50 years old. My kids have graduated college. They're in the workforce now. I believe that I have at least 15 strong years of work left in me. I'm in great shape. I'm completely healthy. I know there's a lot of people out there like me. Unfortunately, I just don't have a huge stellar resume like a lot of people my age because I've been a stay-at-home mom. And I'm finding it really difficult to... Number one, have anybody even call me back and interview me for a job, and I've been looking really hard. I really want to work. And number two, there's really no training out there that's geared towards people my age who want to work, and I'd love to work in the tech industry, so in IT, and it's just really difficult to do, and I don't want to go back and go to school for 4 years and get another undergraduate degree and then in tech or something like that and then have to, you know, try and get a job that most people want a lifetime of experience to be able to even qualify for those kinds of jobs. So I just wanted to shed a little light on that, that there are people like me out there who, you know, we're not going to get pregnant, we're not going to have families, and we have time, we want to work, and we're strong, and it's just really hard because we're 50.
You know, Roxanne Murray, are there resources that somebody in Bilona's situation can look to?
I would suggest that you check into your local or your community, a community access point, formerly referred to as the One Stops. Because they provide a variety of services, trainings, workshops, the ability or the capacity to work with job coaches, folks that can help you look at your resume, look at your history of what you've done. You've said you've been a primary, you know, at home the majority of the time. Well, then over the course of that, you've accumulated and acquired numerous and myriad skill sets. And then part of what you probably may need help with is working with someone that can help translate that work that you did in the home and the skills that you accumulated or you acquired over that period of time. You said you've got kids that are out in the workforce. So we tend sometimes not to focus on the type of skills that we think might not be relevant to potential employers. But anyone who has been home and managed a house and taken care of children and done any of those types of things, manage budgets, there are skills, there are things that you do. And what I would recommend is that you try to connect with one of those entities. There's also Jewish Vocational Services. There are a lot of entities and organizations out there that could help you redirect, you know, that knowledge that you have and transfer it, you know, to paper in a way that would be receptive to potential employers.
Sort of repackage
exactly.
Those skills so that they look sharper on a resume because
mm-hmm.
You're essentially a program manager, a budget
exactly.
director,
exactly.
You know, an expert multitasker.
Exactly.
If you're the primary child rearer, you know how to do a lot of things.
Skill sets that people don't usually or traditionally talk about. So whenever I hear anybody say, you know, I'm just a this or I'm just a that, my response is always that there's no such thing as just a. If you're contributing and if you're doing and you're creating, then you have a contribution that you could make.
Lee emails something that's kind of related to this. He's a 57-year-old unemployed product manager in Silicon Valley who expects to be working until he's 70. Why? Because my wife and I married and started a family later in life, as many in my generation have. So when my son graduates from college, I'll be in my late 60s. I think this shift in people marrying and starting families later is also driving people to work later would change. He says he wouldn't change anything, though. He has a great life, but it is a major stressor for him and his wife to be looking for work in high tech at the age of 57. Jessica Bruder, when you were out on the roads, were you encountering people who were angry in a political sense, or did they all seem to see their stories as personal stories? These are the choices I made. These are the bad breaks I suffered. These are the hopes I have.
There was not a lot of anger out on the road. There were people reading some books about the looting of Social Security. I think there was an awareness and a resignation of the broader situation. But I think a lot of people were spending more time thinking about how to manage the day-to-day than the big picture historically. But when we would sit down and, you know, there were campfire times and long coffee times, they know what's going on. They know that. It's funny, I mean, with Social Security, when people blame themselves for not being able to make enough of that, I get a bit upset since it was never really intended to fund one's entire retirement. The fact that it was supposed to be part of a three-legged stool where the other legs were the pension, which we know has pretty much evaporated, and savings and investments. For many people, those were decimated. In the recession, I met a lot of people who believed the housing gospel that was being pushed out at us by so many pundits that said the market only goes up if you've got investment properties, you're safe. And, you know, you can blame them, but I don't really think that's particularly useful. I think we have a social compact with folks, or we have had in the past, that says you work all your life, you contribute, you do what we tell you, and, you know, there's going to be something for you. And in your older years, you'll at least have some sort of choice about how you spend that time.
There's another issue as well. One of the people we talked to, inherited a property from her mother here in the Bay Area. And then the furnace broke and needed to be replaced, and that was $7,000. And having a property is a plus, but it can also be a drain on resources or something that creates a financial emergency if you don't have those resources. Let's turn now to Joy in San Leandro.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. How are you doing, Joy?
I'm appreciative for you taking my call, so thank you. I wanted to share my personal experience. I'm a mechanical engineer. I worked in aerospace for 13 years. I have two degrees, and I was laid off. And due to not being able to afford to pay my bills, I ended up homeless. And I spent 2 years living in shelters. And I just wanted to say that it is really hard to climb out of that hole. And I have health stuff. I'm on disability right now. I'm going to take a class this fall. I decided to change careers. And I can't wait to be able to go back to work. But retirement, I mean, I plan to work as absolutely long as I can because I went through my 401k before I even became homeless.
Wow, Joy. Thank you so much for sharing this story. I really feel for you. Where do you see things going after this class?
I've decided to change careers because my engineering skills are simply just too old. After a year and a half of interviewing, everyone kept telling me, well, we need new stuff. We can't transfer your skill set. So I'm going to school in accounting, and I've decided to become an accountant. So I'll start using the BOG tuition waiver, which is it's called Board of Governors, and it covers it does free tuition for any student in a California community college. And it's for low-income people, it's for people on public assistance, and people who are receiving any kind of SSI or SSDI. So school, and then I'm using the DOR, Department of Rehabilitation Services. They have programs for disabled people who want to go back to work. And I've already found, like, a government-sponsored program that helps people who, for example, who are new in accounting but have taken enough classes so that I can work for the government because I want to serve my country.
Well, Joy, bless you, and good on you for taking that brilliant turn and saying, all right, these are my skills. If this particular package isn't working in the market, I'm going to turn it around, down but not out. Roxanne Murray, this is the kind of story we want to hear more of, right?
Absolutely. And I know, for example, in my program, I hope Joy won't take offense, but we have, lots of Joys that have various, diverse backgrounds. Not everyone has multiple degrees like that. But what they all share, what everybody I think shares that comes to the, to the CSEP door, is this desire to get back into a position where they're contributing and where that contribution ends up being benefiting them through employment, whether it's full or part time, that will enable them to live some measure of a quality life. They've worked hard. They've earned this. And the whole notion of being able to retire into the golden years just seems to be disappearing, before our very eyes.
Well, on that note, Joy in San Leandro, thank you so much again for sharing your story. Inspiring, as much as it sounds like a really tough one. Thank you also to Roxanne Murray, Program Director at the Family Service Agency of San Francisco. Richard Johnson, Senior Fellow Director of the Program on Retirement Policy at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. And Jessica Bruder, a journalist whose article, The End of Retirement, appears in the August 2014 issue of Harper's Magazine, inspired this segment looking at the growing number of Americans 65 and older who have to work, not by choice, but because they have to. Thank you so much. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.